Woohoo!
Welcome to the Some Work All Played podcast. We are so happy to be with you today.
Happy Tuesday.
It's Tuesday.
And we're coming back together on this Tuesday. We've been apart for so long, and I have so many stories to tell you.
It's been so weird. So I left on Wednesday. It was my very first time being away from baby Leo since he was born.
I thought I saw, did you have tears in your eyes the night before you left? I thought I saw that.
I mean,
I didn't want to call you out in the moment, but I was like, this is sweet.
I just had some allergies, Megan. It was dusty in the room. I'm a man. I don't cry about baby stuff. But yeah, it was very strange. And then leaving you at the same time, we both left baby Leo here with Megan's mom, who's the greatest. So it was a very strange weekend in that front and in many other fronts.
Yeah. Do you want to talk about Grindstone 100K? You put yourself out there. You shot your shot. I'm really proud of you. And you also shot your ankle.
Yeah.
If you were an ankle, you would be shot. If you were a horse, you would be shot.
That's so true.
We're just going to continue things, rolling it out.
Oh my God. That was the Kentucky Derby?
Yeah.
I wouldn't have made it past the backstretch.
Granted, your powers of recovery, because that ankle was a giant sausage-looking thing that would have gotten a horse shot for sure. And you're walking around. You look pretty good. I mean, it still looks, it's pretty sausagey, but it's looking a lot better.
So let's look down at my ankle right now. For those that didn't follow it at all, I actually seemed like I recovered well from COVID, was doing pretty well.
You tested negative the night before, which was so exciting. It got down to the wire where you were still testing positive the day before the race, like the morning of. And then that night, I was fully inspecting on FaceTime. I was like, I'm sure there's a faint line.
And I took the test and showed it to Megan on FaceTime. And I got a great video of you just peering in. So for context, for everyone that might just be tuning into this episode for the first time, I had this big race planned all summer, had a lot of calamities going in, but ended up getting to the start line feeling good. And then sure enough, at mile like 8.5, got quite a good ankle boop, which was okay. I probably would have survived that. But then at mile 11, got one of the worst ones of my life.
If 8.5 was a boop, I think 11 was a boom.
Yes. My ankle got straight fucked. And so right now, looking down at it, it is quite thick, T-H-I-C-C.
It's sexy. The thick ankles bring all the girls to the club.
Yeah. There was a moment where I was unsure if it was smart to stop because, like, I want to keep going. So the really, really bad one was coming out of the mile 11 and a half aid station of 100K. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So, you know, pretty early in the race, I'm like, oh, well, ankles always get better. I'll keep going. It's a long race. I'll excel. So after a few miles, I realized that wasn't going to happen. And I still had like 7 miles to go to the next aid station over pretty technical terrain, pretty far. And it proceeded to be one of the most painful, soul exploring experiences of my life to try to navigate on this ankle. At one point I looked down and, you know, my ankle is covered with a sock, but the entire ankle was spilling out the sides of the whole shoe.
Oh,
like a muffin top ankle. You don't want a muffin top ankle.
Okay, but muffin tops are the best thing to eat in the
world. That's true.
Yeah. I would eat it.
It looked like a blueberry because it was already starting to just get discolored. So I survived. It was an experience and I have a few takeaways from it. It was quite an adventure. I mean, in the big scheme of things, I had big dreams for this race and that was a letdown. But it also really made me think about life and everything that goes into sports and all that. And I think it'll make me a much better person in the long run.
Well, you clearly went through like a spiritual quest out there because you came away from that with just all of these brilliant thoughts. It was like your brain was exploding from the 7 miles that you walked through these technical trails and thought about life and processed life. Because one of the first things you said to me in the airport as you met me at my gate and we're like reuniting is, Megan, I just want to read more fiction. And you're like, I thought about this very deeply on the trail. Yeah. And it's like such a wild thing to think about while you're out there on this like spiritual quest is books.
Well, I mean, that was a microcosm of everything I thought about because that experience and sports in general are great for ego death. You know, it's always a term used in like Buddhism or things like that, where you essentially subvert your sense of self to something bigger than you. And I think sports is great for that because while I was out there, you know, obviously I had these big dreams. I thought things were going great.
And you're so fit. Like, I think that's the really hard thing. And that's what broke my heart, especially when you had COVID, is like, this has been one of the best training blocks of your life.
Yeah.
And I think it's sometimes a little bit scary heading into a race, knowing that you're so fit because it puts like this, I wouldn't say it's like increased pressure, but I mean, the stakes are a little bit higher because you're where you are is so, could be so big.
Maybe it's partially that. I think also, you know, anyone that steps up to a race and has goals, no matter what those goals are, you're making yourself vulnerable in some way.
Yeah.
And so it doesn't matter if you're going for a win or just trying to finish or whatever, you have these big goals and then they get dashed so quickly. And Like, the ego death element of it is essentially making you take a step back and realize that whatever narratives I was putting on it before, whether that was Golden Ticket or whatever, it's all dust in the wind, and grounded me in what really mattered. And what was important for that for me at the moment was the extreme pain. It was so painful on that little walk for 7 miles that, like, I found myself doing a bunch of these verbal tics. At one point, I was out loud humming the Mission Impossible theme song.
Where did that come from?
I don't know. I was like, da-na-na, da-na-na, da-na-na. And it was just to, like, deal with the pain. At one point, I said out loud as I took a step onto my ankle, and it was so painful, that's some spicy fried chicken.
Where did that one come from either?
Megan, I have no idea where any of this shit came from. It came from deep inside of my brain. Like, something that evolved back when we were single-celled organisms to deal with stressors. So, you know, all of that made me kind of take a step back, think about a lot of different things. I thought about, you know, the type of coach I want to be, the type of person I want to be, all of these elements that can kind of fall by the wayside. As much as I want to just, you know, be present and be kind and all of these things, I think, you know, the context of life and the stress of it can make you just think about logistics and all of these other elements that aren't that important. So I came away from that wanting to be the most loving husband possible.
Which you already are.
I deleted Twitter from my phone so that I'm just not doing dumb scrolling and not being present. And then finally, I decided I want to read more fiction so that I can learn through, you know, these experiences of imagination. So I essentially had a psychedelic experience. Mushrooms got injected directly through my thick ankles.
Well, how cool is it that sports can lead to fiction?
Yeah.
I think that's, like, some of the coolest narratives out there. And so when you had this experience, I was in California, and it was so hard for me to be away from you as you were navigating Grindstone 100K. Like, I've been at almost every one of your races.
Actually, for me, it was Grindstone about 11 miles.
Yes, yeah.
It's pretty much a fail.
You did a great job in the 11-mile race.
Yeah, I did. I had moved to the front. I was feeling pretty strong. You know, that being said, I do think I went out a little too hard, which is also an interesting reflection. Not because it felt hard. Like, it wouldn't have gotten hard until the end. But looking at my heart rate file, on the climb, I hit upper end Z3, low end Z4, without realizing it for just a very short period. But that is wrong. And it also points out probably that before this race, I had gotten a little bit too in it for remembering. I think I'd lost sight a little bit of the full process of covering 66 miles, which is the length of this trail, this race, on rainy, tough trails. And I was thinking a little bit too much about, like, putting myself in contention and things like that.
Well, how much do you think the Golden Ticket impacts this? Because I actually I just had a conversation with an athlete, and this athlete has been fifth or sixth at several Golden Ticket races. Yeah. And I feel like it's helped, the Golden Ticket has helped structure and motivate a process for her, which is so exciting. But I feel like also in some sense too, it changes the context of how these races are raced. Yeah. And it changes the context of, like, if athletes are doing these races, like, would you have done this race coming off of COVID, like, knowing everything that was going on and knowing kind of, like, the technicality of this course? Like, I think it's Beast Coast Trails, and you're amazing. I mean, we grew up running Beast Coast Trails, but I think your true skill set is on, like, fast, runnable trails. Would you have done this race if it wasn't a Golden Ticket race?
I like that. That was very kind Socratic method. Yeah. So, you know, in law school, when they're asking you questions, they ask a question that kind of has an implied answer. And that's exactly what you did through that. And you're exactly right. I think, you know, there were a number of different things that went into it that made it not the right choice.
I don't think it was the wrong choice.
COVID, Megan. I mean, like, you knew that I probably shouldn't have done it when I got COVID that close to the race. And I did get a little bit too in it. In terms
Golden
of,
ticket wise, or like,
well, just in terms of wanting to shoot my shot at a time when perhaps I shouldn't have. So I'm very proud of myself because I bet on myself.
Yes.
Yeah. In a way, in every single step of that process, I bet on myself. But sometimes you don't bet on yourself when you're, like, one of those Division III colleges that are playing the University of Alabama in football.
Yeah.
And I think that's kind of what I did. I was one of those teams that gets paid $2 million to go to Alabama and lose 89-0, which is actually an interesting thing about Division I sports, is that the big teams will pay the small teams to come to their university and get their asses kicked. And so I think I was one of those teams in the locker room being like, we're going to win.
You're Deion Sanders over there.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Going to Oregon. And as soon as I got the COVID test, it was always going to be unlikely.
Yeah.
And I'm very proud of myself because I lived my principles in a bunch of different ways. But I think it also pointed out that in living some of my principles, I lost sight of some others in just, like, health being coming first, mm-hmm. the process coming first, the long-term process, all of that. And so that for me is the best reflection ever. Like, setbacks are so good for the soul because it makes you just take that step back. And so I'm so thankful for it. I mean, after the race, I had so much gratitude because I got to see the entire race come through as I was in my cave of pain. And it was so fun. I got to see so many podcast listeners, so many amazing people out there doing this incredible thing. And then I got to go to every aid station and cheer and help crew people. I was rubbing things on people's legs. It was awesome. I got to feel up so many different people. And I mean, I'll never forget that, even more than if I'd had a great race there, I think.
Well, I'm so proud of you because I feel like a true athlete's character like comes out when they DNF or like have a tough race. And you handled this so beautifully.
Thank
so
you.
I was in California. It broke my soul not to be there. But I started my run and your tracker hadn't come through. And yeah. my theory was like, you'd love crinkling your race bibs. And I'm like, oh, he totally just destroyed his tracker. This is yeah. like a classic David Roach thing. So I was holding out belief as you yeah. like, weren't coming through that mile 25 aid station. And as I'm out in my run, all of a sudden I see like the name David Roach appear on my watch indicating I got a text message yeah. from you. And I was like, oh no, this is not good.
Not good.
And I called you on Alta Trail, or you called me on Alta Trail in yeah. California. And you were just like, it's funny because like my heart was broken. Like I was so upset you were going through this, but the like perspective that you had on it, and you were out there cheering on athletes as you were talking to me on the phone. And I was also so proud of you and filled with so much love at the same time
yeah.
that the rest of my run was fascinating because I also had a spiritual journey, like reflecting on running and love and why we do these things.
Yeah.
And like, thank you for handling this so beautifully.
I mean, thank you. But at a certain point, you know, you have to laugh at yourself, right?
Yeah.
And what I always try to ground myself in when something like this goes bad is that it's a comedy, not a drama.
Yeah.
And as I'm suffering through, and it was literally a tropical storm out there.
Yeah. It was so, like all these variables coming together. And yeah, it was curious.
I'm at the top of the mountain, freezing, tropical storm. My ankle is the most pain I've almost ever been in. Like I've told you, it's wild. I've had so many bad experiences recently.
Was it worse than a stomach bug? So you just went through kind of a very nasty stomach bug, which then I got. We've had a rough couple of weeks yeah. here. What was worse, ankle pain or stomach bug?
Stomach bug's always worse. Because yeah. like in a stomach bug, I...
Well, I feel like it's full body. Like ankle, yeah. you can kind of... Here's my theory, is that as you get closer to the head, ailments hurt worse. Like for me, like shoulder pain is a lot worse than ankle pain. I've had like
yeah.
shoulder surgery and things like that. So I feel like stomach is more like full body experience.
I think... The general principle for me is if you could amputate it, it's not as bad, right?
Yeah, you probably should have amputated this ankle at one point.
The way it looked, perhaps. But, you know, you could amputate that. Maybe you could amputate your shoulder. Can't amputate your stomach. So, yeah, a lot, just going through that, it was a spiritual journey. And it was a very funny spiritual journey. And to everyone out there that was following along, cheering for me, or rooting against me, like, thank you for being around for that journey. Because... You know, hopefully one thing we do on this podcast is share the highs, share the lows. If you've been here with us for 3.5 years.
We've had a lot of, I would say actually probably have more lows than highs. We've had more highs than lows.
It's been very fun.
Yes.
But objectively, we've gone through a lot.
We've gone through a lot. But we've also had like an amazing kid yeah. and comebacks and race wins.
Oh, and
that's
this
life.
Is the best.
Yeah.
Like I'm happier now than I was before the race.
Actually, you're happier now than I've almost ever seen you. So you met me in the, so as we were like coming back together after yeah. both of our trips, you met me in the airport and on your screen, kind of like, you know, when you go and you're waiting for a rental car at the airport and they hold up a sign that says your name.
Yeah.
You had written out on your computer, Megan Roach is beautiful, as you were standing there waiting for me. And you just looked like vibrant and happy and soulful. And I'm so sorry that you had to go through this experience, but like, gosh, like, You just seem like you've been through a spiritual journey and it's cool.
Well, I think that's the coolest thing about sports. And so for everyone out there, as you're making your decisions, the reason we say shoot your shots, bet on yourself, take these big chances is partially in doing it, you're setting yourself up for constant failure. Mm-hmm. We talk about that all the time too. I had one of the biggest ones possible. Not only did I fail when I had put myself out there about my goals and been very upfront about them, but I failed so early that it was like there wasn't any potential silver lining to it, really, like from an athletic perspective.
Oh, from an athletic perspective, there is, though. You didn't ruin your body.
It's true. But what I mean is like from a narrative perspective, how about that?
Yeah. Okay.
Like yep. there, it happened so early. It's like, oh man, all these carbs and nowhere to put them. And you know, that really does strip you down to your core to a certain extent. And I think what I learned about myself, and I have, you know, dozens, hundreds of times in my athletic journey, is that when I'm stripped down to my core, like, I love myself, you know? And so as I'm out there suffering, I'm like, I do love myself. And
that's I think you love others so deeply too. And I think like that love of yourself is imperative for the love that you give to others. And my gosh, the way that you are out there cheering on runners, the way that you've come back and have been, I mean, you're always like so invested in Leo, but I see this like new, like dad spark and energy in you. And I love it.
I got that dad spark.
Oh yeah.
There's dad spark plugs. So it was just really cool to see the Grindstone 100K too, in these really tough conditions on this really tough course. Just to give shout outs to the golden ticket winners, Lottie Brinks, Devin Yanko, Caleb Olson, and Caleb Bowen got golden tickets.
We should name Leo, like our next kid, if we have a kid, Caleb.
Yeah, maybe.
Clearly the Calebs are crushing it.
Change that to his nickname. Good story about Caleb Bowen, actually. He was there for my second terrible ankle. At this point, I had already gotten a little down, but the second one was so bad. Actually, after both, I'm in the middle of the woods. On one of them, I fell down and like ate shit. But I scream as loud as I can, motherfucker.
Oh, you added it. So for me, my I say fuck when but motherfucker is like, that's when you know you're about to be so bad. Shot as a horse.
Essentially, that's my ankle judgment zone. Mm-hmm. Unless I say some really terrible epithet, I'm okay. And that, like, seriously, like if I just make like, ouch, it's fine. If I scream motherfucker in the woods, it's a little bad. But Caleb stopped. Got down on one knee and was like, are you okay? And I was just like, go on without me. You're going to do great. But it was a very cool moment. And everybody was like that. Lottie was displaying so much joy at every single aid station that even when she was running a little bit farther back in the field, you knew it was going to be a great day. And then all throughout the field, just saw so many examples of courage and highs and lows and things like that. Points out why this sport is so beautiful. You get to see people go through everything and come out the other end and, you know, you're the same person you were, but somehow you're a little bit different. And for me, at least, that little bit different has like shaped who I am.
Also, this race course itself seemed interesting because it was like you had these super technical sections and then sometimes it would open up into like faster runnable terrain. And I'm always curious as to like how different types of race courses reward athletes. Yeah. And I think these athletes are going to be set up to do quite well at Western States, given kind of like the style of trail running that this race presented.
Perhaps. I think it's tough to know sometimes. I think they're all amazing athletes, so that could be the reason. But I think the course itself, you know, it was really fair. And one of the weirdest part, actually, of my experience when it comes to, like, my senses is the race started at 6 a.m., and we had headlamps on. And then once it got a little bit lighter and your headlamp wasn't doing the work, that's when I just couldn't see very well. And so my ankle stuff, like, yes, you know, it's frustrating, and maybe there's some stuff I can do, but, like, I literally could not see the trail at times, and it almost felt like something with my eyes.
Well, you're uncomfortable driving at night.
Yeah.
And I always thought it was an excuse because you get tired and you're like, Megan, can you take the wheel? But I think there actually might be something there. Maybe you should get your eyes checked.
Yeah. Maybe you should get your eyes checked, motherfucker. That's a really good comment. And then the final little thing I thought about as this ankle happened, you know, I got lots of really nice messages, a lot of really constructive messages about things I can do for my ankle. And I also think it points out some limitations that we all have that are unique to ourselves. And, you know, I've tried to come to terms with over time, and I think we all have to. So for me, my dad growing up was really into sports, played a ton of pickup basketball, things like that. And eventually he had to quit basketball altogether because of his ankles. And he got into cycling and became a very good cyclist.
I didn't know this background.
And he always told me that my big limitation in life was going to be my ankles. He's convinced that it's a genetic thing. Every male in his family has had incredibly bad ankle injuries. And, you know, so I think part of it is understanding that whatever limitations were served, whether they're something like this, that your ankles just are kind of shitty, or, you know, your VO2 max is like really low or whatever it is. It's just something that we're have to handle and have to make the best of. So for me, I'm not going to let this get me down. I'm going to keep shooting my shot. I'm going to keep doing technical races, and I'm going to keep believing because, you know, and I'm going to try to do the things I need to do.
I was going to say ankle PT.
Granted, my dad did say, you should get surgery.
Oh, I don't think so.
No, I agree.
Let's not make those ligaments tighter so then you can rip them again.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, there's a lot to come from this. I'm really motivated for the future, but right now I'm really motivated to heal because those ankles still thick.
Well, ankles are overrated appendages.
Yeah.
That's my hot take. I sprain my ankle all the time too. And I found myself sometimes when I'm trail running, like anticipating an ankle sprain.
Yeah.
And it's one of those points that I'm like, Megan, I just have to clear that thought from my brain. So I totally feel you on those ankles. So that being said, like for me, when I sprain an ankle, I feel like it never goes full boom to the point where I can't walk on it. Yeah. Usually I'll just sprint it like six more times when I'm able to get to the finish. And the full boom ankles, I feel for you.
Yeah. Well, so it was quite an experience. Do you have any other little things to tell me before I move on into like, I don't know, a farm upstate or wherever we put people with these types of ankles?
Well, just next time you're coming wedding dancing with me. Okay, so while you were at Grindstone, I was at this wedding. And again, it was like so hard to be apart from you. But I also do feel like it makes those moments of coming back together even more magical. Yeah. And we saw that with Leo too. Like we left Leo with my mom and my sister. And it was so cool coming back with him. But I feel like for me, one of the best gifts in life is having Leo be cared for people that I love.
Yeah.
And it's like sharing that community of love. So it was hard to be apart from you. But next time you're definitely coming wedding dancing with
me. Well, maybe while trying to do the stanky leg, I would have torn an Achilles.
So or maybe you would have strengthened your ankles.
Oh, no, but I'm saying something terrible could have happened.
That's true.
So yeah, I think all in all, the future is bright and I'm so excited.
I'm so excited.
Okay, so we have an amazing episode for you today. We're going to have a few more things about the Grindstone 100K mixed in. Talk some Jim Walmsley takeaways from our big interview last week.
Oh, that was so fun.
So fun. The best sports story of the year that you might not have heard. A fascinating cycling periodization study. Talking about the world record in the marathon. 2:11. Insane for women.
That's bananas.
Mental health and coaching. And finally, hot takes. We have a bunch of hot takes today because I feel like after that experience, I just want to talk to you about random shit.
After that experience, you came up with like 25 hot takes and they were all really good.
Okay. So we asked our Patreon crew about different hot takes. We got 7 pages of Google Docs hot takes and I just did the first 10. Those are just the first 10. We literally have like 400 of them. So I can't wait because some of them are spicy.
Maybe at some point we release a bonus episode that's just hot takes.
I love that idea.
So that was going to be when we were feeling sick
yeah.
last week or like 2 weeks ago with COVID. We were like, oh, well, like our backup episode option can be recording a whole thing of hot takes, but we should just do that anyways.
That would be so fun.
Wouldn't it be fun? It's just rapid fire back and forth.
Okay. I don't know how the listeners all feel about hot takes. I know our Patreon crew writes them, but I love them so much because it's essentially an opportunity to hear you unvarnished on like really weird topics.
I'm not 100% unvarnished.
You're pretty unvarnished on this podcast.
Like 95% unvarnished.
95%. That's
yes.
perfect.
Yeah.
Okay. So patreon.com/swap, S-W-A-P. There we do bonus posts. We do bonus podcasts every single week. We have 70 of them built up. So I guess that's like a full many days worth of podcasts that you can go listen to if you sign up right now.
It's kind of wild to think about the number of minutes that equates to. Yeah. That's like more than 2,000 minutes.
Yeah. And there we just answer questions. So listener questions. So lots of fun. So first, Jim Walmsley, Megan. We got Jim Walmsley on the podcast last week.
We did it. Boom, boom with the joom, joom. Yeah. I got to tell him about how much we use that expression around here, which is minorly embarrassing, but also I think cool at the same time.
I think he was a little confused. I don't know if he fully understood the context of why we say boom, boom with the joom, joom.
Oh, he got it.
You think so?
Yeah. Oh, he definitely got it.
Okay. I think by the end of the podcast, he really did get us.
Oh, yeah. Oh,
to
yeah.
To a certain extent.
For better or for worse.
We got to stay on for afterward for 45 minutes and talk to him and his partner, Jess. That was really fun too.
It's because Wi-Fi in France is so hard to yeah. come by that it took forever for his file to upload, but it was actually great. We were holding Jim captive.
And then even cooler, after he got off, he went and did trail work with Francois Dehaene, the other best, one of the other goats.
Actually, Francois is like one of the only goats we're missing on this podcast.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, I wonder what he would say if we asked. We'll see. Maybe we should ask. But tons of reflections on the Jim interview. First, like, it was got tons of listens. It's kind of one of those moments in the podcast that's just really cool. Make sure you click follow on the podcast. Give it 5 stars. Helps us to get these goats. Also really helps the podcast. One of those very cool moments where we're getting to interview some amazing people on here.
Yeah, were you nervous? I actually wasn't nervous at all to interview Jim. I haven't really been nervous for our interviews. They've just become fun conversations.
I get nervous every time. It feels like a date. Kind of, you know what I mean?
Yeah, but it feels like a date, but with my wingman, which is perfect.
Awesome.
Like, if I had to go out in the world and date with you by my side, I would be fearless. I'd be like, let's bang on the first date.
Interesting analogy. I respect it. Don't know if I follow.
Do you affirm it?
I affirm you in every context. You're allowed to express yourself fully. But I thought there were some great interview takeaways that would be really cool to talk about. First, let's just jump right into the training volume in the training discussion, because I think that that was a place where Jim has never really opened up like that. And he was really excited, I think, to dig deep with us. Also, at one point, he said he really liked my articles.
Oh, I was so excited.
Yeah. Wasn't that cool?
You did put that in your Trailrunner bio. These are Jim Walmsley approved. Jim Walmsley reads these.
At one point, he's like, I think they just came out too fast. Yeah. Like, wow, Jim. That's why I barely write anymore, because they did come out too fast and I burned out.
Because you got to appease Jim Walmsley. Like, well, a lot of his training has been on Strava, and I feel like it's been a helpful blueprint in some sense for some runners. But I also feel like 99% of runners, actually 99.99% of runners that try to do what Jim Walmsley does will end up in a puddle on the side of the trail. You use that phrase on the podcast, and I really like that. Like, description, but it's really instructive. But for his recent buildup, he didn't have anything on Strava.
Yeah.
And it was fun to dig into the weeds of what he did for UTMB.
Yeah. And I thought it was very cool how he's evolved his training. So he said he looks back at his younger self and wonders how he did that. And now his training is huge, but it's also controlled.
Yes.
So
yeah, it's not Anton.
Yeah.
Like, I think
Kropitschka, who, if you followed this sport back in the late 2000s and 2010, early 2010s, was putting on his blog, which was amazing, and was my first exposure to ultra running.
He's a great runner.
He would do 180 to 200 miles a week, almost every week, in minimal shoes, over the mountains, and things like that. And Jim, meanwhile, is known for his extreme training, but in the context of training, talked about only doing 5 really big weeks.
Oh, but those 5 weeks were big. So it's like 125 mile weeks.
Well, 225 mile weeks, 115 and 200s.
Yes.
And tons of vert.
Yes.
So 40 to 55K.
As we were going back and editing the podcast, I heard that come back up again. And of course I heard it as we were interviewing him, but I gave an audible gasp as I heard the 40 to 50,000 feet of vert a week and that mileage total, because yes, it's not Anton, but it is still really, really big training. But what I think to me, what I took away from that is I feel like a lot of the goats are kind of coalescing right in this mileage range. So Courtney, Jim, Adam,
Killian,
like, I think are all doing very similar training concepts. But I feel like for me, it defines the far right point of where you can go with training. Like, I think there was a bunch of people that tried to repeat what Anton did and, like, you know, don't have Achilles anymore or you know, like are fully in a puddle on the side of a trail. But I do think there's a very, very, very small percentage of people in our ultra running world that can do that far rightward point of training.
Yeah.
And I was curious about that.
And also I thought that was interesting how he structured it. So in those 5 big weeks, he spread that out over a longer period of time. So he's doing big training in the other weeks, but not quite as big. And so he's doing these big pulses and giving himself time to recover, pulse, recover, pulse, recover. And I think it's a great lesson for everybody in that we've talked about overload weeks in the past and the science of overload training. He's essentially harnessing that around what he's capable of. And he's doing it in only a semi-structured way. So he knows the, you know, microcycle and macrocycle goal.
But it was more structured than I expected.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah. And actually much more structured than other goats seem to have, like Courtney or...
I mean, Killian's pretty structured.
Killian's very structured. Yeah, that's true.
Yeah. And so, you know, he was building up to those 125 mile weeks with tons of vert. And, but he wasn't doing that every week, and he wasn't certainly not doing that year round. I mean, he cross trains a ton in the off season. You know, he builds into this and then he does a ton of this work very easy. Mm-hmm. Probably if we did an intensity distribution on him, 90%+ of it would be in Z1 or Z2 in a 5-zone model, Z1 in a 3-zone model, which is really interesting. Like, again, every single athlete across sports is kind of doing this type of training. I think the difference in running is that in cycling, we might see, as we're going to talk about a study in a few minutes, that that type of training is spread out like kind of throughout the year. Like, they're doing that for a long period of time. In running, Jim's like, I don't need that many weeks of this. He talks about 5 big weeks and he was ready for his UTMB breakthrough. So that's pretty interesting.
In like listening to him and learning from him, does it change how you think as a coach? Because I think it is interesting because we're learning from people who are extreme outliers. And I think a big point of what we've talked about in the podcast is like, it's hard to apply extreme outlier training theory because they have the genetics of, you know, freaking goats and they also have the work ethic of goats too. And it all comes together in this way. Listening to Jim and hearing about this, does it change how, and thinking about how the goats are coalescing, does that change how you're going to change coaching?
Great question. I think that it doesn't necessarily, because I've already incorporated this.
Yes.
To a certain extent.
Because the principles of it across different ability levels.
So the wrinkle here is that Jim has an incredibly high VO2 max. All of these goats we've talked to so far are incredibly talented. And what we've talked about before in the podcast is if you have a really high VO2 max, it takes very little speed work to adapt to your full potential. And Jim even said that on the podcast. It was a fascinating point that 2 weeks of focused workouts and he's ready to run a PR half marathon off of ultra training. That is anomalous. That is not something most people would see. And the reason that is because he's incredibly talented speed-wise. And so for people that aren't, they might need to build in a little bit more of that throughout the year, a little bit more structured work. Mm-hmm. But then in other times, like, you know, what I learned from Jim is these overload weeks might need to be a slightly bigger emphasis, and to think a little bit more about overloading vert on those weeks, to essentially tell athletes, instead of trying to get a lot of mileage as the goal, though that can be a goal if you're a high mileage athlete, try to like load up on vert for, you know, probably 4 or 5 weeks, which is something we've talked about before, but I'm going to focus on it even more now before mountain races across the board.
Well, for someone that's not doing 40 to 50,000 feet of vert, like let's take a 70 mile per week athlete. How much vert, like, do you think it's a similar vert ratio to what Jim was doing or slightly less? Like, how would you structure that?
I think 20,000 is a good sweet spot.
Yeah.
When I see athletes get to 20,000 feet of vert, I'm like, okay, you're probably ready for most races. But it varies a ton. Again, Jim is a male athlete, for example, and that is a hugely different context in recovery than most female, than the average female athlete, even the average elite female athlete. So what Jim's doing probably isn't sustainable for very many female athletes. Like almost any female athletes, maybe zero. And what Jim's doing is probably sustainable for just a small portion of male athletes. So I don't know. I think all of these things are taken as kind of like a portrait of training, and it's like a watercolor that you're reading into. How about you? Any takeaways in particular that you're focused on?
Well, actually, I have a question for you.
I like this. Yeah.
Well, I think for what I'm curious about with Jim is like, again, as I talked about, like, I feel like he's really defining that like far right point of training that athletes can do.
Yeah.
But I think as coaches, if we gave that training to 100 athletes, like 98 of them would break.
Yeah.
But how do you identify like the two athletes or the athletes that are like the two athletes that could sustain that or the athletes that are able to take that next leap into higher levels of training that might use some of these theories? And like, how do you identify that as a coach or as an athlete if you're coaching yourself?
I mean, I think you're just probing the edges.
Yes, exactly. And yeah. You're continuously, I think as a coach, you're continuously probing the edges.
Yeah. And like Jim did this in iterative fashion. I think what is so was the breakthrough about Jim initially when he came into the sport is all of a sudden he was absolute beast and unstoppable on the world level. And that came when he greatly increased his training. Mm-hmm. Like looking back at some of that, it was insane. And those that trial of miles, that huge risk that he took initially was an important leap for him. And I think every athlete kind of applies that. So I view it in a two-pronged framework. First, and we've been talking about this in your training, actually,
yes,
maybe we can even bring that in, is that if you've never done the trial of miles where you take a big risk and increase beyond the scope of what's possible in your head, until you've done that, like, you don't know. You have no idea what you're capable of. Okay, but once an athlete has done that, like Jim did back in 2016, then it's all about just small incremental changes to take these risks, understanding their risks and understanding your body and listening to the body. So first comes the trial of miles, take those shots, see what happens. Then comes small little changes after, because once you've adapted to the trial of miles and tried that, the body does such interesting things.
Well, you used a great point. So yesterday as we were driving home and like lighting up the drive with conversations because it had been 5 days since we saw each other, you used the term callousing the body, that the trial of miles calluses the body. And we're thinking about that from my own training context right now because I'm coming off pregnancy, I'm coming off a heart issue, and I spent so much time sitting on the couch doing nothing. And I feel like my body went from a calloused body to mileage to all of a sudden being in a slightly different context. And we talked about the idea coming up here that I'm going to do a slight, I mean, definitely nowhere near Jim Walmsley, but like a slight trial of mile build because I feel like I lost that foundation a little bit as an athlete and I need to start callousing my body to the mileage before then I go then and bump up into speed. Because right now I feel like I could run 7 minute pace like efficiently all day, but dipping down faster feels biomechanically inefficient. And the only way to do that is through speed, but I also need that foundation of mileage to get to the speed healthily.
So are you going to go full Joom Joom?
Oh, I'm going to go boom, boom.
Joom boom, boom with the
Not
Joom
Joom?
Not
even full Joom Joom. Actually, a few listeners, so we spell Joom Joom, J-O-O-M.
Yeah.
And a few listeners spell it J and then the U with like the tilde above it and then M. And I like that.
I think it must be a meme or something that we missed out
on. Oh, maybe we missed the meme. But we should have asked Jim for confirmation. Like, how do you spell this?
Yeah. But I think your training context would be really interesting and instructive to listeners. So you played field hockey, then you came into running. And throughout all of this, like you had been an athlete since you were 4 years old and you had some breaks throughout the process. You even had a surgery, but throughout that process, you're very close to athletics and you'd done the trial of miles for yourself. You had done all of this stuff before. So you were always pretty close to like peak fitness.
And even if I had a minor injury or something, like I had to take 4 weeks off or something, I would come back so fast.
And you cross train.
And I would feel efficient off the board.
Yeah.
Whereas not coming back from pregnancy in my heart, it's like I feel biomechanically wildly inefficient.
And I think it's especially the heart. Like yes, pregnancy, yeah. Like you would have been able to train through. But with the heart, you got totally shut down. And I think probably you took 6 or 9 months off.
Fully. Where like
1,000 steps a day type off.
Yes. Yeah.
If that, where you, I mean, just walking up the stairs would make your heart rate go through the roof. So you detrained to such an extent that your body lost those trial of miles type adaptations. Mm-hmm. And like now, if you try to build back, like, you know, with speed, like you might've in the past, like you could excel off 40 or 50 miles in the past with speed because you had that history.
Mm-hmm. My body remembered it so easily.
And I think that history kind of got erased by the heart because not only did you have the heart, you took a ton of medications that kind of had to reset your body and shut everything down. And so you just lost your calluses.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And now I got to get them back.
Yeah. You excited?
Oh, I'm so excited. I'm excited to be a callus motherfucker.
I love it. Your calluses are going to be so fucking sexy.
Oh, thank you.
They're going to be in all the right places.
Oh, well, hopefully, I mean, sometimes the trial of miles, it's like, it is a touch risky, but yeah. I do feel like as an athlete, it's like, I'm ready to do that and ready to be smart in the process. And I'm really excited.
And athletes, I think, rarely get injured from truly easy work.
That's true. And that's a big thing is in this process,
yeah.
For me, I'm going to have to focus on like true Z1 work.
Because and talking about ego death.
Yeah. Oh, yes.
Ego has to drop by the wayside a little bit because mm-hmm. those days that are so satisfying where you might run faster or whatever, those are so risky and kind of like set back some of this process that yes, you can incorporate them sometimes, but you got to be careful with that shit. Mm-hmm. So like, you know, I'm subverting my ego in one way, you're subverting it in another, and we're going to meet in the middle with like fully dead egos, but lots of love.
Fully dead egos are going to come alive. They're going to like spiritually join and light up in flames.
Oh, so much joom joom. Okay. Do you want to get to the best sports story ever?
Okay. Yes. This happened actually a couple of weeks ago and yeah. because of the Jim Walmsley interview, we didn't get to talk about it. And I'm so excited.
Yeah. So you might have missed this unless you're a cycling fan. This is Sep Kuss, born in Durango, Colorado. He's actually, I think he went to Colorado, the University of Colorado.
He did because he holds so many Strava segments around here.
And they're so fast.
They're untouchable. Like I feel like actually Strava's gotten a lot more competitive over the years, which is cool because there's so many more users,
yeah.
so many more runs, but he's at the top. It's like Sep Kuss from 2013
yeah.
holding the leaderboards forever.
And it is a wild reflection on just how good cyclists are. In fact, Jim made a quick comment on that when you asked about cycling. He's like, yeah, those guys are just so wildly strong. So Sep Kuss has always been this super talent. And he found his way onto the Jumbo-Visma cycling team, which is currently the best cycling team in the world by far. And his role there has been as the head domestique, which is the term used in cycling for the person that supports the leader. And where his major contribution was is in the mountains. Mm-hmm. So he would just stay next to the leader, stay in front of the leader, pace the climbs, chase down breaks when needed from the key rivals. And you can see it in the results. So from when he joined Jumbo-Visma to now, they all of a sudden started dominating at the grand tours, like the Tour de France, the Giro d'Italia, and the Vuelta a España, the three big ones. To the point that they had started winning almost every race with Jonas Vingegaard and Primoz Roglic. And the whole time, he's just the lieutenant. He loves it. He takes pride in being the person that supports the leaders. And it seemed like he had no more ambitions than that.
Until the Vuelta. You set me up perfectly yeah. for that. It's like setting me up for the mic drop. And at the Vuelta, he got into a break early on in one yeah. of the early stages and wound up winning the stage. And it was kind of to everyone's surprise. Like he was supposed to be there supporting Vingegaard and Roglic, his yeah. teammates, as he like classically always does. But then all of a sudden he finds himself on the leaderboard
with
unexpectedly.
A few minute lead.
Yeah. Which and is big in cycling. Yeah.
Especially when you're an incredible climber. Because like he would never be able to get a few minute lead organically. In the context of racing, if he was trying to just like do it from the peloton of leaders, from like all the leader group. But what happened is the other teams made a mistake and underestimated him as this domestique, let him get in the break and then didn't chase it down immediately. Because let's say Primoz Roglic or Jonas Vingegaard, the other amazing cyclist who have won Grand Tours on his team, got into that break. The break never would have been allowed to get more than 30 seconds at the start. They would have closed it down immediately. They would put an entire team on the front, the other teams, to hammer, to catch it. Because if you let those guys get even 10 seconds, you're fucked. They let Sep Kuss get a few minutes. And they didn't think they were fucked, but sure enough, it was going to be spicy to even try to get close to him.
But what was even spicier, though, was the team dynamics on yes. Jumbo-Visma. Because all of a sudden, you have this domestique, and the general classification riders of Vingegaard and Roglic honestly were kind of like, what the fuck, I think, in their heads.
Well, they're competitors.
And I think the thing about GCs are they're like the Michael Jordans of the world.
You can't get to that level by being a domestique attitude.
Exactly. Right? Yeah.
Sepp Kuss's attitude, we love it. He's the kindest guy. Listening to him on podcasts is just like, what a cool guy. In fact, after he won that break stage, the best meme was he's on the podium and they give you bottles of champagne to just spray, not to drink. He puts up this huge bottle of champagne, downed like...
He chugged it like it was water.
Yes.
It was... I can't even chug water that fast.
Yeah. It was incredible.
How is he like walking the next day, let alone riding a bike?
Apparently he was just totally wrecked. He was just so hungover because he's also a very small dude. And he just was on the podium like super woozy after that. But that's not the GC mindset. These guys, you know... It started, it's like a cycling lore thing from Jacques Anquetil all the way to Miguel Indurain, Lance Armstrong, you know, whatever these people were doing. The reason that they are so famous for doping is because they're fucking killers.
Oh, yeah. And do you think Tadej Pogacar would be classified in this killer category? I'd like to think.
Interesting.
I have a minor obsession with Tadej Pogacar.
Who wasn't at this race.
Yes. Was he second at the Tour this year?
Yeah.
Yes. Tadej Pogacar, I feel like, would be an incredible domestique GC hybrid. I feel like he could do everything.
Yeah, usually though,
his personality, I feel like, fits. Yeah,
those people are hiding it to a certain extent. Like, he's being authentic to himself, but he clearly has
GC in his cells.
He has the killer instinct in him that he wouldn't ride for another rider. Like, you can't reach that level while being just like totally well adjusted and normal.
That's a great point. Well, anyway, So Sepp Kuss's teammates didn't support him very well.
Yeah.
They were out there in future stages, like attacking him, going for stage wins.
Well, to a certain extent, it was a really interesting situation. This is why it's the best sports story of the year. It wasn't just, oh, Sepp Kuss gets in a break, his team protects him, he wins. So on his team are the two favorites, which is really rare. It never happens. And there's a stage called the Englerou, which is the hardest climb in professional cycling. It averages 18%, which if you know that from running, it's a hiking climb for over 2 kilometers.
Except you don't hike a bike
in
these tours.
Well, some people probably do.
Yeah, but it's bonkers to think about getting a bike. And at those grades, running is far easier than biking.
In fact, I read about one rider who was going to be in the back who said any spectator that pushes them, if they put their phone number in his back pocket, he's going to give them a prize.
Oh, this is how I'm going to get Pogacar. I'm going to go and I'm going to like train for this. And I'm going to push Pogacar up that mountain and slip a baguette in my phone number and be like, give me a call.
Actually, though, his partner is a really good female professional cyclist too. So,
oh, true. She would eat my soul.
No, not necessarily. You do have the killer instinct, but you know, as we work on the Trial of Miles, maybe that's the motivation for the Trial of Miles.
Oh yeah. To push Pogacar.
So what happens on this climb is the entire pack gets whittled down till it's just the key contenders. And third wheel is Sepp Kuss. First wheel is Primoz Roglic, who has won this race in the past. Second is Jonas Vingegaard, who just won the Tour de France. And Primoz starts riding away, makes a gap on Sepp Kuss. So what happens usually is Sepp Kuss leading this race. If you start to ride away from him a little bit, you wait and you stay with him and help him get to the finish. Primoz did not do that, despite Sepp Kuss in the past doing that very same thing for Primoz.
Time and time again.
Sepp Kuss has been able to ride away at certain stages and waits and waits and waits to be with him. And so the jersey is going away. He's not going to win the Vuelta. This fairy tale story is not going to happen. He's hemorrhaging time at the top of this climb in this rainy storm. What happens next? And what happens is Mikel Landa, who's a leader on another team, rides up and catches Sepp Kuss from behind, says, get on my wheel. Sepp grabs his wheel. And as Primoz is riding away, Sepp does the biggest sprint around Landa to keep that jersey just by bonus seconds, by a few seconds. And so he's wearing the red jersey of the leader and he gets on the line. And then the apocryphal story, we don't know if this is true, is that in the team bus that night, the domestique that always just works for other people stands up for himself and says, you would not do this to anyone else. This is my race to win. We ride for me.
And that's the moment that I'm like so proud of because it's like it takes a lot of courage to get up and like sprint and, you know, close those seconds. But speaking up to your teammates like that and saying like, no, you need to rally behind me when you're on Jumbo Visma, which has historically the best GCs like in the entire world, to me, that was like the crux of the story.
Yeah.
But also, David, I feel like something happened to you in your spiritual like quest of 7 miles at Grindstone, because your storytelling is off the chains right now. I'm like, I don't even want to talk. I just want to let you keep going.
Maybe we should do like podcast storytelling time.
I think it's fun. Yeah.
I love telling stories, but on the
you're
podcast,
really good at it.
There's not that many opportunities to talk about things that people might not know about already, because we kind of like preaching to the choir a little bit usually. And I'm assuming people might not know about cycling. So Sepp Kuss wins the Vuelta a España. Totally unexpected. He is the ultimate underdog story. And a lot of people had adopted this underdog story. So on Twitter, there was an account made a few years ago called GC Kuss, General Classification Kuss, of people that were always joking, saying, let him get his shot. And you know what? It happened. The fairy tale fucking happened. First American to win a Grand Tour in 10 years.
So. I was going to say, I'm curious to see like the ripple effect of how this ignites cycling further in the US, because it's been so long since this happened.
Yeah. And the last person that did it is one of the sketchiest stories in cycling history. It's Chris Horner, who is now a commentator on these cycling networks.
Well, I feel like so many of the Americans have doped.
I mean, it's just cycling.
I mean, I guess that's true. It's cycling across the board, yeah.
Chris Horner won the Vuelta a España 10 years ago. I think he was 40 at the time.
Damn.
And he came out of nowhere and was putting up huge numbers. Cycling in the old days was insane.
Was he doping? Was that like, did that have ever come out?
If he wasn't doping, then I won Grindstone. Then my ankle isn't thick as shit right now. Yeah, he's clearly doping. But, you know, the fact that, like, the story now is one that is so wholesome. So, obviously, you never know what people are doing. But if there's anybody that I think would be clean, it would be Sepp Kuss. Just because he has said, and in one of his favorite quotes, I wish I had put in the podcast outline, was something along the lines of, doing sports is accepting that sometimes you're not good enough to be the best. And that's something he did very early on in his cycling journey. As soon as he went to Europe, he understood that he's not the best and that's okay. And that realization and understanding led him to being the very best at what he does, which is
for himself.
Supporting.
Yes.
And supporting others. And that also makes me confident that maybe he is clean, because, you know, if you accept that you don't have to win, and that you can have experiences like I had at Grindstone, where you fail on a big stage and it's okay and you'll be fine, and you don't have to be a killer to be accepted, then I think you might not also cut corners. So in Sepp Kuss, I see a champion that like is who I want to be. I don't have the killer instinct. And yeah, I don't have Sepp Kuss's talent, but maybe I can be a little bit of Sepp Kuss chugging that fucking champagne on the podium. Just like, how the hell did this happen to me?
I love that so much. Well, you told me too. And I think it's always important when I talk about stories on the podcast, I'm like, you told this to me. So if it's wrong, we're like playing telephone over
here.
I think
every couple does that though, where there's a moment where like, hey, did you hear this story? And then the other person's like, you told me that story and I think you made it up.
Yeah. Well, you told me this story.
Yeah.
That apparently, didn't Sepp Kuss say that he didn't want to be a GC rider after all of this experience? Like after all the trials and tribulations that he went through, he's like, no, take me back to being a domestique. It is not worth this. It's not worth the champagne.
Yeah. And I think it's okay to be a domestique in life.
Yeah.
You know, that's my calling. As much as I wanted Grindstone to be a great day, and I've had great days in the past, I've had those freakish days. When I first won a national championship in 2012, I would probably have been picked 30th on that start line. I beat the US cross country champion, and I did it with like a total naivety in what I was capable of. Like, I've had those days that were just like the Sepp Kuss days, my version of that. But I'm a domestique at my core. And for me, like while cheering at Grindstone, I was like, oh, this is actually my calling, as much as I'm going to keep putting myself out there and going for it.
Which is good, because you're incredibly fit right now. But I think actually for me, bringing this back to the discussion of golden tickets, I think you don't have to go for a golden ticket.
Yeah.
And the number of athletes that I've said this to recently, because I think that's been this like this huge funnel into ultra running, and it's like everyone's dream to get a golden ticket, but it's not worth your mental health. Like sometimes like being a domestique is freaking amazing. And there's so many amazing races to run out there that are not golden ticket races. And so I think only do it if it's authentically true to yourself.
But sometimes domestiques win.
That's true. Yes. And I think, but I don't think you always have to structure every single season
for
a golden ticket.
And the idea being you're enough no matter what.
Exactly.
And I think
yeah.
embracing that domestiques are fucking awesome also gives you a chance to know that, like, you know, if Sepp Kuss didn't win that race, if he ended up finishing second behind Primoz Roglic, he'd have been fine.
Oh, yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
You know, and similarly, by embracing that, like, you know, I'm disappointed on some level, but I'm happier than I've ever been.
Well, actually, to some extent, if he had gotten, I'm always curious about what happens when a big race win happens to an athlete.
Yeah.
Because it sometimes does change the relationship with sport, and sometimes it's in a very negative way.
Yeah. Well, yeah. I am confident that's not going to happen with him because he was like, fuck this.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm good.
Yes, yeah.
So he's going to go back to being the king domestique, and I can't wait to see what comes next. So in all of our lives, let's be a little bit more Sepp Kuss and a little bit less Lance Armstrong. I think that letting yourself be guided by uplifting others, going for it and standing up for yourself when it's time is so, like, you know, validating in this journey of getting vulnerable, which is the whole point of doing sports as an adult that often has like other jobs and other shit going on. We don't have to do this, but where it's really valuable is in the personal growth that comes from, you know, trying really hard, failing sometimes, failing most of the time, and sometimes succeeding beyond your wildest dreams and downing a lot of alcohol.
And I think accepting, I just love what you said, that like you don't have to be the best.
Yeah.
What's what Sepp said. But I also think you also don't have to be your very best either.
True.
Like I've settled at this point of like, you know what, if I'm 98% of my best, I am happy with that.
Well, you had said 95%
before. I know, I'm raising my yeah. I'm raising my stats. That's like going into the trial of miles. But I think it's always important that for me, I hold back at least one, maybe it'll be 99% yeah. in a month. I hold back at least one percentage point.
I love that so much.
Yeah, but it's not worth the mental health sacrifice.
So we're going to transition slightly to a cycling periodization study. This is very topical because we just talked about cycling. So this is called the Weekly Periodization of Top 5 Tour de France General Classification Finishers. It was in the International Journal of Sports Physiology and Performance, just came out. And it used a retrospective power data analysis of two cyclists from December to July as they trained for the Tour de France, finished in the top five. This is fascinating because every time we look at the like very peak edge of endurance performance, mm-hmm. especially in cycling, we're seeing what works on physiology when you don't have injuries, because cyclists don't really get injured in the same way runners do. When you have everybody trying as hard as they can, training at the limits, what works the best?
And I think this is very similar to the conversation about like Joom Joom and the goats.
Yeah.
Is we're kind of seeing this defined right word limit. And how does that shift how we think about training for
yeah.
everyone, understanding that these are also outliers too? So what they did was they peered into this, the training distribution of two different cyclists. There's yeah. cyclist A, who is 29 years old, and cyclist B, who is 23 years old. And they looked at the number of races, the weekly volume distribution, kind of the intensity distribution, and even things like, were they training at altitude?
Yeah.
And what I found fascinating, actually, is that these athletes, these cyclists, were racing a lot.
Definitely.
So in the season, cyclist A raced 46 times.
Yeah.
And cyclist B raced 19 times. And obviously, you can do a lot more biking races than running races, given the context that it's not like loading the body from a biomechanical standpoint.
Yeah.
But I think there's so much power in doing races as fitness builders, as chances to like find out more about yourself.
Definitely. And especially as that incorporates into training theory more generally in the training distribution. So I'm going to go through some of the other findings here that I think are relevant to the racing discussion. First, the weekly volume of these riders averaged around 20-ish hours per week, which isn't insanely high when you think about cycling being non-weight bearing. The older cyclists did more, 22 hours, to the younger cyclists, 18 hours. Makes sense. As we get older, we can sustain a little bit more volume usually. Pyramidal intensity distribution, this gets back to what we always talk about, most training easy. The higher volume cyclist was doing 81% easy. The lower volume cyclist was doing 88% easy, which is pretty wild. Like that's a huge percentage of easy training, much like we talked about with Jim Walmsley. The interesting part is that the time around those races got mm-hmm. more polarized. So
yep.
the races themselves were the hardest training stimulus. And I think runners can learn a lot from that, that like our races are our biggest training. And actually that brings me back a little bit. Swap athletes had an amazing days at the Mammoth Trail Fest 26K.
Oh, that was so exciting. Actually, this was an incredible race weekend
yeah.
for us. It was really, and I imagine in some sense that helped with the whole ankle situation.
Yeah, true.
It was like athletes were throwing down at so many different races.
But, you know, in coaching those athletes who are at the very top of the world level in running, so this is kind of like the Tour de France of trail running,
mm-hmm.
these athletes that are doing the short distance stuff. Like what I was telling, like Anna Gibson, let's say, who's come into the trail scene this year and was third at Pikes Peak and fourth at Mammoth at the international level, is this day is the hardest day you'll ever do. It's essentially the equivalent of three workouts.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, Anna dealt with some ankle sprains during the race. And in fact, I said to her at one point after the race, this was before my race, don't worry about it. Ankles are made to get fucked. I was definitely begging the karma gods to smite me at that moment. But the point being, those races are hugely stressful, mm-hmm. so much more stressful than any workout. And think about that, how that changes intensity distribution. So it's great to race, but as you consider the fact that, you know, almost 90% of training is easy when you're doing high volume, that means that you adjust, you know, in the subsequent periods before and after to make that a little bit less intense.
And I think for me, whenever I think about training distributions, it's always helpful to break it down. Like it's always presented in percentage points.
Yeah.
But I think for me, breaking it down in terms of minutes, it's helpful as I actually think about the context of training. So for this, for Cyclist B, they did 88% of time, as you were talking about, in zone one, then 7.9% in zone two, and 3.3% in zone three. But if you think about the context of like an 8-hour training week, that's 480 minutes. So for this cyclist, that's like 15.8 minutes, only 15.8 minutes of time spent in Z3 context of the training week.
If they were training in eight hours a week.
Yes, if they were training 8 hours a week. And I think it's like, that's actually not that much time when you think about it. Like if you think about, you know, 8 hours and 15 minutes, like how, I think for me, it's always much more instructive to think about training intensity distributions.
Yeah.
Sometimes in hypothetical minutes per week.
Definitely. I mean, I like that. I also think the complication becomes if you're not doing incredibly high volume.
Yes.
So Joom Joom is like these cyclists. He's probably doing actually very similar peak weeks to them, like around 20 hours.
Yeah, I was going to say, we would see this shifted if this was a classic 8-hour week.
So if you're doing 8 hours, you're able to do a little bit more intensity. But the question is how you want to distribute that overall. And I think where it differs a little bit for runners that are doing lower intensity is you can bulge out in the middle. So Megan said 88.8% in Z1 in a 3-zone model. As always, that's Z1 and Z2 in a 5-zone model. 7.9% in the middle zone, 3.3% in the top zone. Runners can bulge out that middle zone a little bit if you're doing lower volume to run uphills.
Especially trail runners, because there is that uphill stimulus, and I think you can get that safely without biomechanically breaking down.
Especially at lower volume. Mm-hmm. But remember, most needs to be easy. Every time we see one of these studies, it shows the same thing. Mm-hmm. And after a while, like I actually had my come to Jesus moment after Grindstone is I even need to remember to be more accountable to this. Like I'm going to start quantifying my training more like this, because like I'll take, you know, a 10-mile easy day and sometimes just go fucking chase Strava segments like I was doing in Chamonix.
Yes.
And you know, that's awesome. And it just displays my fitness. And it actually, here's a little pithy quote. Mm-hmm. It proves my fitness, but does it improve my fitness?
I like it.
And I think, as runners, we need to be careful not to seek out proving our fitness over the benefits of improving it. And it, you know, at this level of cycling, the cool part is they are so solely focused on improving, because the time they prove it is once a year at the Tour de France. Much like Jim said, the only time he really proves his fitness is at UTMB, which is a ton of pressure, but also distills training theory down to really cool elements.
We also think, especially for trail runners and runners, but compared to cyclists, there's also an environmental context to proving fitness.
Yeah.
So for me, for example, I feel like sometimes here in Colorado, I feel a little bit, I hate to use the word slow, but I objectively feel slower because the trails have rocks, we're at altitude, like going uphill is sometimes a crawl. But then I go to California on the weekend, this weekend, and it's like, there's so much abundant oxygen in the air. I'm running much faster. And I feel like I think different environments are easier to prove fitness.
Interesting.
And I feel like for me at altitude, like I have to go hard to feel that fitness, where at sea level, it's like, oh, I'm just jogging and feeling fitness. And I think it's important to always recognize the environmental context that you're in and training in, and recognize how that relates to proving fitness, and that you don't need to do that.
I love that so much.
Yeah. Does that even make sense?
Oh, totally. I mean, gets the cyclists, only one of them did any time at altitude.
Yeah.
Might be related to power, you know, in cycling, being at altitude makes you put out less power. And over time, like that can be tough, especially it's a little complicated in cycling. And this gets back to the conversation we had before about doping, where, you know, if you're doping, you might not need to spend as much time at altitude because your red blood cell count is already maximized. Well, it might
be dangerous at some point if your blood becomes too thick. Yeah.
So there's a lot of complications here. But as always, these studies show the same thing over and over, which is these intensity distribution models where at least 80% is easy and often more than that. So be comfortable embracing your easy. Tune into that. Be accountable to it.
And never try to prove yourself on easy days. I think that's for me. It's like when I go out the door, it's like, this data file truly does not, this is not a test.
Definitely.
And I think I think so many athletes, that's like each run is a test, and it's like, no, I'll throw that out the window.
Yeah. And you know, let's ground it in runners. So I was talking about the Mammoth Trail Fest.
Yep.
So Mika Boudin-Rousseau finished second, an absolute breakthrough for him. And this coming week in training, theoretically, it's all easy. It's a high volume, easy week. But the reason being, if we are doing an intensity distribution model, he spent almost all of that race in Z3. Like, mm-hmm. he crossed the finish line, and it was really helpful to watch the live stream of it.
Z3 in a three-zone model.
Three-zone model, yep. Yeah. So Z5, I mean, literally, he went all out. He crossed the finish line, passed out. I was actually worried that he needed to do one rollover to cross the actual finish line. So huge breakthrough. And then it's like, okay, if we think about that in a longer-term intensity distribution model, then we need to load up on Z1.
Yep.
Even though it's not just one day when you do that. And similarly, think about how hard your workouts are, how much you are running uphill and your efforts wandering, all of those little things to try to mimic this model a little bit.
Well, I think as we talk about heart rate and zones and like distribution of training, we're also forgetting about the psychological impact though of races. Is I feel like for Mika, that race is a huge central governor stimulus. And it's like you carry that forward, and that's outside of this zone model. And I do think it's also important to think about, like,
so the brain stimulus.
The brain stimulus. Like, I think it's important to think about, like, you know, I think so much of the time we think about training theory in terms of heart rate zones, but all the other bodily systems that are going into
there. Especially the nervous system.
Especially the nervous system, yeah.
Yeah. Nervous system's often ignored. And another reason to emphasize recovery throughout the process.
Yes. Yeah. Don't fuck your nervous system.
But sometimes you fuck it real good.
You gently fuck it.
Or but
sometimes you got to lay it down.
Remember Tenacious D, you don't always have to fuck it hard. In fact, sometimes that's not right to do. But then at the end.
I'm totally missing that song.
You don't know Tenacious D?
I mean, I do know Tenacious D.
Megan. I'm a little bit worried about our relationship.
Worried about your singing. Is that a common song? Are you singing in like a different tone?
I mean, you know, I'm not saying I'm a good singer, but like
you are a good singer.
People that know Tenacious D would know the reference.
Okay.
So
fuck.
I've never loved you more than this, but I do today, generally. But at the same time, I'm a little bit worried, and we might have to talk to a marriage counselor.
I'm very sorry
about the situation. But so that song is it's called Fuck Her Gently, right?
Yeah. Oh, okay. I think I do know that song.
We'll play it right after.
Okay. Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. But at the end of the song, it has like a little moment where it's like, but sometimes you gotta fuck her hard. And that's what you gotta do to your nervous system. Okay, let's get on to some other stories. First one is a fascinating point about running. We might only do one of these because I really want to get to the
Hot takes. Okay.
Is that Adidas came out with $500 super shoes.
Yeah, what the heck? Actually, I was like blown away by this. And then I was in the SFO airport this weekend.
Yeah.
And I paid $20 for an omelet.
Okay.
And as I was sitting there, I was also in like a spiritual moment, and I was like, I can't understand the $500 shoes. Money is just, I feel like inflation is rolling wild.
No, it's not inflation. What are you talking about?
It's not inflation. Okay.
A $20 omelet is not a super omelet.
Oh, it was a delicious omelet.
Okay, was it a super omelet?
It was a super omelet. It was worthy to be a super omelet.
It was 4% better than every other omelet.
Actually, it was great because as soon as I bought a $20 omelet, I was like, I'm eating this whole omelet, the entire plate, every single ketchup packet because I need my full $20.
Actually, maybe it's a good lesson to spend a lot of money on food, even if you don't have it.
Yeah, especially if you have low energy availability. You gotta eat that shit.
Yeah, it makes you be like, oh fuck, now I gotta eat this thing. Yeah. If you put avocado on something, you gotta eat the whole thing because it's like that extra $3 I'm never gonna get back.
Those millennials are onto something.
Yeah, exactly. The avocado toast makes champions. Yeah. May not be able to buy a house though.
Yeah.
But I think it was an interesting moment economically. So those shoes came out before this past weekend in the Berlin Marathon, and I was appalled by the $500 price tag because we talked about this a little bit on Patreon, but I think it's weird to reflect on the price points of this being relatively arbitrary. It has nothing to do with the cost of research, the cost of materials, the cost of design, the cost of manufacturing. It has everything to do with these shoes as a luxury item. Mm-hmm. The same reason that a Gucci bag might be elevated in price, even though the materials cost nothing, is why these shoes are elevated. Because Nike came into this market with the original Vaporflies and charge $250. They set a price point that if you are under $250, you are inherently less valuable as measured in a capitalistic system. So Adidas, I love it. They're just like, fuck this shit. Let's make it clear that we have the most valuable shoes. Let's price it at $500. And to me, it was the grossest manifestation of just unabashed, shameless free market capitalism. Because if you price a shoe at $1,000, are you saying that that's going to be the best shoe? And are we just going to price everybody out of this market because of, the greediness inherent in these systems that will prioritize luxury over, actual cost of goods and services?
I agree. And I'm curious to see the return on the shoe. I was skeptical. I was like, oh, I don't think at $500, I think the shoe is not going to take down the Vaporflies or the Alpha Flies. But what that being said, the Women's World Marathon record was set in the shoes. And now all of a sudden I'm a believer. I'm like, give me those goddamn $500 shoes.
I know. So I'll podcast in those motherfuckers.
Well, it's actually, we were talking to a company recently about the value of Jim Walmsley.
Yeah.
And I feel like world records and Jim Walmsley, there's a huge value to shoe companies because it's like, for me, I trust Hoka's, especially like the Speed Goat Evos. We should have asked Jim about the Speed Goat Evos.
Yeah.
He could probably bring them back for us.
Yeah. I don't think even Jim could bring back the Speed Goat Evos.
You don't think so?
They've died. I've heard the stories behind the scenes.
I believe.
But yeah, that is shameless capitalism. But it was Tigas Dicefa, ran a 2:11:53. They skipped for women the 2:12s and the 2:13s.
Well, she got the record by 2 minutes and 11 seconds, which is the most, I love numbers. Like when numbers align on like race bibs, I get really exciting. But she ran a 2:11 marathon and broke the record by 2:11.
Yeah.
And how cool is that?
It's kind of cool. It also makes me feel a little bit like unusual. It's so fast.
I mean, she's had a history of running well. So she competed actually in the 800 meters.
Yeah.
This is only her third marathon, but she did come in and she ran at like a 2:30, I think a 2:34 is her first marathon. So she's dropped time fast.
Yeah. And obviously she's incredibly talented. She's an incredible athlete, but everything about this story.
Are you a skeptic?
I feel dirty. I feel dirty.
Yes.
Not saying she's dirty or Adidas is dirty.
Yeah. That's a great way to phrase that.
Let's think about every element of this story.
Yes.
Start. $500 shoes announced.
Yep.
They probably did that knowing she was going to perform this way, right?
Yes.
So there's a lot of pressure on her because I think that this was geared towards her. This was thrown at her. And she comes in, resets what's fully possible in these shoes. So you can see the pressures of capitalism on one end with the pricing of the shoes, the marketing of the shoes, put onto the athlete where she understood her role in this big story, which is to sell shoes.
Yes.
And what do you do when you are an economic instrument of results being the only thing that matters, where if she runs a 2:18 or 2:19 and finishes third at this race, she's worth nothing to Adidas, almost nothing.
And she probably needs that. And I think that's some of the challenge with like,
well, everybody needs that.
Yes, that is true.
Okay. Everybody needs to be the, but I'm not saying she's coping.
Yes.
I'm just saying it introduces economic incentives, capitalistic incentives, just like the shoe pricing that we'd have to be idiots to deny.
Yeah.
And I worry that, you know, I want to be an idiot, right? It's like the X-Files. I want to believe.
Mm-hmm.
I want to believe in everything. I've been burned so many times before that I think believing, you know, like with your full heart right now, understanding the context of it, understanding how the shoes incorporate into that is putting your head into the sand and just hoping you don't hear a sound.
Okay, I like that because actually I was thinking about, I think when I saw the world marathon record, I wasn't thinking about it in conjunction with the shoes.
Yeah.
I was like, oh, the shoes much work. I didn't think about like, it's funny because like so much of my research is thinking about like relationships and drivers of relationships, but I never thought about the bidirectional arrow and like how that impacts things. So you just convinced me every time. But here's my question to you is like, do you feel this way every time a world record goes down? Because statistically, like you probably should. Yeah. And it's a hard place to navigate is like, belief and excitement and joy with feeling like dirty and smelly.
Yeah. You watch the spectacle, Megan. Enjoy and embrace the spectacle.
Life is a spectacle.
Yes.
I mean, our life has kind of been a spectacle if you've been following it the last couple of weeks.
I think that's the hard part about sports is understanding the statistics of outliers versus the reality of giving a shit about sports at all.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's why I think it becomes a little bit harder to believe when you see such big leaps and big leaps from a person like it should be shown from age 12 on at this point.
Well, she went to the Olympics in the 800 meters.
Yeah. The point just being you're an outlier by so much at this point.
Yes. And I actually agree with you on this. I just think it's important to have to push you on it. But I actually agree with you. I feel dirty and smelly and sticky and all the things. Yeah.
She's incredible. And like, she doesn't deserve to be questioned without evidence, which I have zero of.
Yes.
And no one does. But I do think on the podcast, we need to give voice to what everybody's thinking.
Especially in conjunction with $500 shoes. And I think that's what brought us to this point.
Yeah. So let's celebrate her, even as we're skeptical about the systems that are in place that can create negative actions from good people.
Okay, that's a perfect conclusion.
Is it?
You tied that up beautifully.
I'm trying to be positive.
Yeah.
But it is remarkable. And whether it's just the maybe it is just the shoes. Maybe.
Maybe they have like a motor in them. That's what costs $500.
Or just maybe it's like they are that good. And we'll see. Because that would actually give me hope.
Are you going to try them?
Am I going to try? No, because they can only be worn for one race. That's the other gross thing about this.
Yes, I agree.
Did you know that?
Well, I actually, it's kind of like the $20 omelet principle.
Yeah.
If you have a $500 pair of shoes and you can only wear them for one race, I feel like there's this like pressure to send it that might actually be kind of good in some situations.
I like it. So just like you had to eat the whole omelet.
Yeah. If you get a $500 pair of shoes, you're gonna PR.
You're not gonna hit the wall.
You're gonna eat the eggs and the potatoes and the toast and the ketchup packets.
Perfect. So good. Okay. I think we just go straight to hot takes. What do you think?
I like it. Let's do it. We've got so many good ones.
Okay. Before getting to hot takes, I just want to tell you that the only thing that's made me bring this great energy is Athletic Greens. We talk about it all the time on the podcast. So many of our athletes are taking it, and we absolutely swear by it. So drinkag1.com/swap, S-W-A-P. As we talk about, you know, our concerns about doping, the best part about Athletic Greens, it has all of these adaptogens, all of these supplements that elite athletes at the top level are probably thinking about taking, things like ashwagandha, you know, all of the different things that help the body adapt, but it has it in a certified safe for sport package, which is the only place. So you know what you're getting with Athletic Greens. They fucking rock.
And you know, it's good because it's green.
It's green.
Also, I feel like we've concocted all the various different ways that you can use Athletic Greens at this point, but we've never talked about rubbing it on your ankle.
Yeah. And number so many people, Megan, when I posted the photo of the ankle on Instagram. So the ankle looked gross yesterday.
It was gross. Actually, what I told you about Instagram was you can post the picture of your ankle, but don't post the toenails. Toenails are unacceptable. Appendages are okay.
Megan made me block the toenails. In fact, I didn't want to post the foot at all, but you told me I should. Why did you tell me I should?
I didn't tell you you should. I was like,
no, you did tell me
I should. But I feel like it's important context of like, you know, sharing your whole journey.
Okay.
Yeah. Also, it was pretty epic. I'm not going to lie. Yeah.
So I posted it and promised it would be my last foot photo.
Okay. I said you could post one. You posted two.
Well, no, I asked you the second time too, Megan. you're trying to create a false history here. I'm skeptical about you right now.
Are you going to rub some Athletic Greens on
you? You didn't know Tenacious D, and now you're lying about my Instagram post. You told me to post that. But I got three general cohorts. The first was people saying, oh no, I love you. Cool stuff like that. Which I love. I appreciate you. Thank you. Number two was saying, no, post more, which I thought was an interesting one. They wanted to see some feet. Number three was saying, rub some Athletic Greens on it, which I thought was really funny. So I don't know what would have happened to my body if I didn't have Athletic Greens, but I'm very happy I did have it on board.
I'm so glad. And we should rub it on the ankle.
Yeah. So drinkag1.com/swap. Do you want to get to hot takes?
I'm so excited. But first, can we talk about Jonji?
Okay, yeah. No, we can't talk about Jonji yet because we have to get to hot takes.
Okay, but Jonji is a hot take.
What is that about?
Is that they're so fucking great. And here's my hot take is I'm eyeing some like races ahead.
Yeah.
And we're waiting desperately for our singlets and our crop tops to come in. But the only thing better than racing in a swap crop top is racing in Jonji.
Yeah.
I'm going to race in Jonji ahead. I'm going to mix it up.
I had a full Jonji kit on.
You did. It was green on green.
Yeah.
Do you have any photos of you from the race?
I actually don't think I do.
Okay, that's the problem with DNFing at mile 11 is that you didn't make it long enough for photos. You got to at least get to like 40 so you can have some photos.
That's pretty embarrassing when you think about it.
It's not embarrassing. Well, Megan, David, you literally couldn't have done anything about this ankle.
I spent 2 days doing my 8 to 12 grams of kilograms of carbs per day.
And it's all aligning for this podcast. Yeah, that's why you're telling such good stories.
I carb loaded so much. I had so much caffeine. And then I get to mile 11 and a half and can't use any of it. Because everything about my physiology was designed to go 66 miles on these trails. And now I'm just using it on a podcast.
How did the caffeine feel the rest of the day? You should have like coached and done some like, you could have written probably a whole novel.
Okay, that's another takeaway. We'll get back to Jonji.
Yeah.
Throughout this whole process, one of the biggest understandings I have about my spirituality is that caffeine determines so much about my mental health.
It does. So on Friday, you went off caffeine and you called me.
Just the day before the race.
The day before the race. And you called me and you were like the captain of Sad Boy Track Club.
I wasn't Sad Boy Track Club.
You were Sad Boy Track Club
calm.
So hard.
I was Calm Boy
Track
Club. I
was very worried about you.
I was Sleepy Boy Track Club. But on race day, I not only had coffee, which was awesome. I haven't had coffee recently. I've been doing tea. That was amazing. But I had a 100 milligram caffeine gel. I would have had like 7 of them if I had finished the race. And the rest
I told you to have 4 max.
I was going to have 7.
Okay.
And I felt so good and happy the rest of the day.
Happy Boy Track Club.
And part of my realization here is I'm going to harness caffeine a little bit better throughout my life for my mental health.
Well, are you going to go off caffeine again the day before the race? Like, I don't know if those... You seemed so down about the race.
I was away from you. Okay. I missed you.
Yeah.
Okay, I'm allowed to be sad when I miss you.
Oh, you're allowed to be sad anytime. But it just was like, I feel like the day before the race is not entirely a convenient day to be sad.
It was fine.
Okay.
And I felt great on race day.
Yes.
Everything was awesome. But I am going to be a little bit more intentional about my caffeine use during the day, especially after exercise, because I want to harness the mental energy in such a way that makes me a better father, husband, and coach, and also much happier.
Well, as we were on our trips this weekend, we both coalesced on drinking coffee again.
Yeah.
It's delightful. It's great.
Well, we'll see. I think we should wait to bring that to the masses because we're not 100% sure yet.
Oh, I'm all in.
Okay, you're all
in. I'm all in on coffee and gluten, and my life has never been better. I went back to eating gluten after our trip in France.
Yeah.
And I was doing it for autoimmune reasons, but there's like the science isn't like strong enough for me to really change my life. And gluten is fucking game changing, and I'm so happy I'm back to it.
And I've decided I'm gonna cook every single dinner now, partially because you're back on gluten, and I'm like, oh, I don't have to think about this shit so much anymore.
Oh, gluten is so good.
It's so good.
So good. Also, I was realizing too, like, being gluten free really, my food options were so limited that I felt like I lost some weight after being sick that like I couldn't afford to not eat gluten.
Yeah.
And it's so much easier from like an energy availability perspective to eat gluten. So this is my justification.
We'll see.
I need it.
We might change by next week, but
that's true. Yeah.
For now.
Been through our journey of coffee. Yeah. We've been like on and off coffee 4 different times throughout our podcast journey and alcohol. I'm still off alcohol.
Well, for context, I love this. We're just going different directions before. Who even needs
this? This is a whole hot take by itself.
This is supposed to be Jonji.
We gave a Jonji hot take.
Megan, this has nothing to do with Jonji. What the fuck are we doing? But there's a study that just came out. The reason we switched to tea and really dialed back our caffeine intake was because some of the science. So a study just came out called The Effect of Caffeine on Subsequent Sleep, a Systematic Review and Meta-Analysis from Sleep Medicine Review Journals. And essentially what it found is that caffeine consumption, to a certain extent, reduces sleep by 45 minutes and sleep efficiency by 7%. And to avoid reductions in total sleep time, this is a quote, coffee, 107 milligrams of caffeine per 250 milliliters, should be consumed at least 8.8 hours prior to bedtime, and a standard serving of pre-workout supplements, 217 milligrams of caffeine, should be consumed at least 13.2 hours prior to bedtime.
And those numbers are wild.
Yeah.
And I actually abide by that. Like, I never have caffeine after 11 because I'll be up all night.
Yeah.
And 11 a.m. Yeah.
We saw that it affected our sleep to a certain extent, and so we're like, oh, well, this matters. And you know what I've decided? Fuck sleep. You know what I need?
What?
Happiness.
Stoke. Hype.
So we'll see if we sustain this.
I think we will.
In small amounts. We're not going to go too far. While I was reading the Dave Grohl book, which is amazing, storyteller, make sure you read it. It's fantastic. Lead singer of the Foo Fighters. He talked about that at one point, he got on such a caffeine habit that he would have like multiple pots throughout the day. And in between those pots would fill it in with like Monster energy drinks and things like that. He calculated his caffeine intake at, get this, well, actually, first, guess what he would have caffeine intake per day?
2,200.
5,000 milligrams of caffeine.
What? That's wild.
And maybe this is why he's so spiritual. He saw God every single day.
Maybe this is why you're so spiritual. You had that big caffeine during the race, and then your brain exploded.
Exactly. So, you know, there are interesting considerations here, but we dusted off our coffee maker, put every piece of it through the washing machine, and this morning, I think we brought a good energy to this podcast.
This podcast has been fun. Let's finish it up with 3 hot takes.
No, we haven't even promoted Jonji yet.
We just did.
No, we didn't.
Okay.
You just said it.
Okay. Well, I love Jonji.
You need to use offer code SWAP, S-W-A-P, at Jonji.com. Buy their apparel. They're the coolest company. We love them so much. They might give you the power of 1,000 suns or Dave Grohl's 5,000 milligrams of caffeine.
Yeah, Jonji. One Jonji item is at least worth 500 milligrams of caffeine.
So true.
How many milligrams do you think you do a day? Just out of curiosity, as like a reference range.
So, I mean, for a long time I was doing caffeine. Or, I mean, tea, which is probably
just, you were doing caffeine. Yeah,
50 milligrams of caffeine a day in the morning, and that's it. Sometimes I would do a little bit more on top of that. And I think I'm going to go up to anywhere from 100 plus or minus 1,000.
I was going to say 4,000.
Yeah. So the air bars are going to be quite large as I figure this
out. And in negative caffeine directions.
Yes.
Yes.
Yeah. Some days I will go to 0, which feels more like a negative 900. Okay, let's do some hot takes. First one. Walking treadmill lunges should be added to the mountain legs routine.
I'm actually going to give this a negative.
Walking treadmill lunges. Why?
Yeah, that also sounds dangerous.
Why doing it on the treadmill?
I probably eat shit doing that. Yeah, do it somewhere else.
Couldn't you just do it anywhere?
Also, I do feel like sometimes walking lunges can irritate athletes' knees.
Yeah.
So be careful with them. Yeah.
Yeah. I just also think it's so interesting to think about this athlete.
But I really like this athlete. They're clearly thinking.
Yeah, I like it.
This is like, did you submit this? You would try to figure this out.
It does feel
you would do it on like an uphill. It'd be like a 15%. Don't do that.
Yeah.
But you would do that.
I would try to solve a problem that doesn't exist.
Yes.
Yes, very much does sound like me, but it is not. Remember, if the treadmill belt is moving for you, you can also do that on ground because you can move.
Yes.
So yeah. I don't understand why the treadmill is important. Maybe it is though. I don't know. Maybe they're mixing into running. So maybe they're like doing an interval, then doing a walking treadmill lunge and then running some more.
I like that.
What do you think?
Yeah.
It sounds like kind of like a CrossFit-y thing.
Yeah.
So we'll see. Don't recommend this, but do think that lunges are a great part of your routine. This is a part of the mountain legs routine, the speed legs routine. Basically, everything you've seen from us includes lunges in some context. Really good, especially rear lunges. If yes. you don't do rear lunges, they are wonderful. You might do them once and your butt hurts all of a sudden. And it's like, wow, what is going on? It means you're activating your glutes.
And those are the muscles you used to climb.
Yeah.
It's great. Good yeah. Rear lunges are magic. Okay. Next hot take. I really like this. No one has a real job anymore. And then like 6 exclamation points. This is sincerely a Gen Z giving boomer vibes.
So this is a Gen Z person that said no one has a real job anymore.
I actually appreciated this one.
I because, do too.
You know what? I love my job so much that it doesn't feel real.
Well, also our jobs are fake.
Well, our everyone's jobs are our, like, be specific.
Our personal jobs are fake.
Why?
If you can do your job from home, I kind of think it's fake.
Okay, no, everyone can do their job from home. That's what the pandemic proved.
You can't manufacture a widget
that's
from
home.
That's true. Like, you can't milk a cow from home.
Yes, like...
Well, actually, I guess maybe you could. You could program the milker.
This is how we're going to get AI that's like going to rule the world. It's no, doing it from home.
But I'm just trying to put myself in this person's shoes, like what they're saying.
Yes.
And do you ever have that moment where you're going past like a skyscraper or something, like yeah. something that's like 60 stories and you look up to the 40th floor and you're like, what's that person doing with their lives?
Oh yeah. All the time.
Because I was one of those people.
And oh, and sometimes I feel like that. I feel like sometimes there's this culture that like, if you're not struggling deeply with your job, you don't have a real job.
Maybe. Yeah. What I think what this person is saying is essentially like Excel spreadsheets don't count as real jobs. I think they're saying like jobs are the means of production to bring us back to our economic discussion, bring mm-hmm. some Karl Marx into this.
To produce some $500 shoes.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I mean, true. But the point just being like, I think we all struggle with that to a certain extent is
oh, yeah.
what are we doing with our lives mm-hmm. and spending so much of our lives doing, and is it real?
And that's why trail running is amazing.
Yeah.
It's because it takes you outside of that.
True.
Yeah.
And sometimes you truly fuck your ankle and you're like, oh, that's real.
Yeah.
Even if the reason I was doing it isn't real, the fact that my ankle looks like a beach ball is a very, very real thing. So to bring it back to like real things or like things that might be like concrete takeaway. If you're out there and you have those misgivings about your job, one, you can quit your job. We always suggest that. But two, know that everybody does. I feel like even someone that's doing human rights work, that's saving the world.
Or even like surgeons probably feel that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Or Malala probably yes. feels yeah. like that sometimes. Malala is just like, should I have been an accountant this whole time? Do you think she thinks that?
Oh, for sure.
For sure. Definitely. We all think that sometimes. Okay. I like this one for the last one. The presidential debate season should include a 50K for all candidates. If you can't run the trail, you can't run for office.
Hell yeah, is my response for this. It would be fascinating to see how like what a training approaches and racing approaches yeah. all the presidential candidates would take. Like Trump will get on like a bike and a bus. He would run like 1 mile and then you would see him at the finish line winning and he'd yeah. be like, I did it all.
No, he would not even do that.
He'd be on marathoninvestigation.com.
He would never even do that. And yeah, he'd just be like, I've run so many marathons, so many great marathons, the best marathons. And so I have good things and bad things about this hot take.
Yes.
Bad things first.
Yeah.
Bad things is you don't need to run to be fully worthwhile.
Yeah.
And I think I love this as a joke. I don't like it as reinforcing ideas that...
Okay, well, I think it's a great joke.
You need to do an joke. But
yes.
I think the good thing is that why are our politicians so fucking old?
Yes, I agree. Actually, like, I was going to say...
across the board. Like,
we might kill them.
Yeah,
maybe that would be a good thing.
No.
Not a good thing. But like, this would be survival of the fittest.
Hunger Games are politicians.
Exactly. Make them run a 50K.
You need to be like fucking Rue out there.
That's what we want for a leader.
Katniss.
Yes.
Katniss for president.
Yeah.
No, but the point being like, I think there are some really, really smart takes that a weird thing has happened in society where we're governed by, it's like the gerontocracy, right? So like septuagenarians mm-hmm. are running government across the board. I think that's, you know, great. Everybody should be able to do anything they want, but it becomes a problem when you consider just basic incentive structures where you're essentially relying on someone to think about generations, many generations in the future. And you're using systems that, yes, many people can become 98 years old and have an evolved perspective. But already I'm looking at the way that 20-year-olds look at the world enviously, because they've grown up in a different context than I have. And we're in our 30s. So, you know, have you ever had an 80-year-old try to use a computer? Now imagine understanding new concepts, like the wild things that we're thinking about in the world. So I think
okay,
need to have some sort of test.
I agree with you.
I don't
you.
Think it's a 50K, but there needs to be some sort of test.
I agree with you. But I also think, so I
we need to have an empathy test. Yes. Not a fitness test, an empathy test.
Yes.
Because you need...
But you also, that happens during 50K too. Especially if you DNF.
Maybe.
We should make them DNF and see what happens.
Okay.
But I think actually there is a huge issue of ageism though in the workforce.
Yes.
And the presidential area is like one place we don't see that, but it's like massive in other areas of the workforce and probably shouldn't be there.
Okay. I get it. But where do you draw the line?
I know. Okay. I hear you.
So yeah, like in, obviously it goes,
we should just give them all athletic greens.
It's true.
Then they would live forever and we'd be okay.
Okay. So, and also, you know, I don't think age is a problem in and of itself. I just think it's a problem because what it reflects on our political system generally, that because, you know, it, like our senators and stuff can just run for all these terms. You have like Chuck Grassley and Dianne Feinstein like up there, and you're like, guys, like this is our best and brightest at this point. Like, I don't know.
You're going to be brilliant at 85, David.
I don't trust myself. I'm way too old already to be a senator, man. Like, I want to go to sleep at 6 p.m. I could never be in the Situation Room. So maybe that's actually the test we need. Instead of 50K, what we need to do is say, can you stay up till 11 p.m. Do something that really stressful?
Oh, like, and do it repeatedly.
Yeah.
I did it this weekend and then got up at 6:30 a.m. for a run and I am wrecked.
So we're disqualified from office.
Exactly. Yeah. Which I'm happy with.
Yes.
I would much rather be the domestique than be the GC
yeah.
in the United States government.
That's a perfect way to end it. Yeah. Okay, do you want to get on to Listener Corner?
Let's do it.
As always, we love you all. Thank you for everything.
Your
messages
been so fun.
Mean yeah. the world to us. And here it is. I'm only sort of a runner, but I've been doing all of the things you recommend, and I had the most fun, best feeling run of my life today. PR'd every section, felt super strong, and it affirmed all of the wisdom squeezed in between jokes about banging prairie dogs. Forget us saying that, but apparently we said that at some point. I'm wondering if you'd ever write up a training plan that's for those of us who are coming to running later in life who will never, run a 50K, but want to keep stacking bricks and maybe a shorter race distance. It's been a super vulnerable act to start running, to share my slow pace on Strava, even to wear shorts, etc. I'm getting to know my body in a new way, and some days it feels brave. Some days it feels super humbling. It would be amazing to have a training plan that's in my strike zone. Also, please never start a cult, because I'll have no choice but to join, and I do not have the bandwidth for that.
Oh, we would start a low bandwidth cult.
Yeah.
That's the only way. We do not have time to invest in a high bandwidth cult ourselves.
A cult that asks almost nothing.
How great would that be? Yeah.
Yeah.
That's also my dream friend group.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
Okay.
We invest a lot in friends, but also sometimes you just need this friends that like you cannot talk to for like 2 years and then you message and it's just like a delightful relationship.
That's kind of what we need in general. Yeah. We got to be honest, Megan.
But that's how we would structure a cult.
Oh my God. The cult that checks in once every 4 to 6 years.
Yeah, exactly.
Just with a text that says, hey man, thinking of you. How you doing?
Come meet us at Burning Man. I'm just kidding.
But no, we don't even need Burning. Like, and then I don't know. What will this cult be building to? Like, what is the purpose of this cult?
Banging prairie dogs.
Banging prairie dogs.
No, I'm just kidding. Yeah.
No, I like that. That can be the purpose. No. Yeah. Maybe we need to think about it long term but I do think a low bandwidth cult is perfect. And to this listener, let's start right at the beginning. You said, I'm only sort of a runner. No, you're a fucking badass beast athlete runner. And embrace that right now.
And let's go to the middle too, about never running a 50K. Yeah, like fuck 50Ks if you don't want to run 50Ks. But we have coached so many runners who have said they will never be able to do it, and they do it.
And you know what else you can do?
What?
Fail a 50K.
Oh, yeah.
At mile 3 or whatever my equivalent
Just stay long enough for the race photos.
Yeah. And the point being that like you're enough no matter what. And that's the cool part about athletics is that you don't have to have these qualifiers. You don't have to say, I'm sort of a runner. You don't have to say, I'll never run a 50K. You don't have to say, you know, in my case, I'm not going to get a golden ticket now or any of these other things or I, you know, whatever. You can just say, I'm a badass fucking beast that puts myself out there. And athletics is the place where I get to express parts of my soul that are really hard to express elsewhere.
And you can say, I love me some me and I love me some of these sexy cankles.
Do you love my ankle?
I do. Yeah, I affirm it. Awesome. I would like it to be a little smaller just for your own sake.
Thank
but
you.
I do love it still.
It's a little black and blue too.
Yeah. Ooh, it's tie-dye.
Yeah. Much like your bra, which is John G, that is a little bit all different colors. You look so beautiful right now, Megan. I missed you so much.
This is how you give Jonji promotions. It looks like a sprained ankle. No, but actually this is beautiful. It's called microflorism. It's very cool. It's got lots of, bunch of little flowers.
A spilf.
What's that?
A sprain I'd like to fuck. No, but I missed you so much. And it's so fun to get to be with you again.
Yay. We get to tell stories and have coffee and gluten.
And start really low bandwidth cults that end every meeting with
huzzah!
Huzzah!
Gluten!